This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about anxiety and OCD. To start off, I've got a definition from the NHS on OCD. Obsessive compulsive disorder is a common mental health condition in which a person has obsessive thoughts and compulsive behaviours. One of the things that's important to mention here is that OCD is actually considered an anxiety condition. So whilst there are different types of anxiety, OCD does fall under the category of anxiety conditions. The type of other anxiety we'll be talking about today is generalized anxiety disorder, which is the most common. It's also the most common mental illness in general. So with these two conditions in mind, this is the second time we've covered dual diagnosis on the podcast. But it is something that can be incredibly common, that many, many people that experience one mental illness experience another one either at the same time or separately in their lifetime. We previously covered anxiety and depression, and that was one of our most popular episodes. So that gives you an idea of how prevalent experiencing more than one condition can be. Was there something you wanted to mention?
Well, I just wondered then whether or not us using the term dual diagnosis is then right, because if OCD is an anxiety, is it a dual diagnosis?
Well, in this case, we're talking about generalized anxiety disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder. So those two are separate, even though there can be a lot of crossover in symptoms.
Okay.
Yeah.
Continue.
No worries. And so I've got some stats up next on the prevalence of these conditions. So first off, for OCD specifically, I've got a stat from OCD UK, who found that it affects 1.2% of the population, which is around 750,000 people here in the UK, based on current population estimates.
That you just hear so many people say, oh, it's my OCD, and they just haven't got a clue about what the people that we're meeting, Bobby, that really are suffering, compared to those that think because they're quite tidy or...
Yeah, you know. Well, the people that use it as a punchline.
Yeah.
It's difficult to know why, but OCD seems to be one of the conditions that is most commonly reduced down to a stereotype as opposed to a real condition.
Yeah, and anxiety, actually, funnily enough. I think they're the two that people use flippantly. Oh, it's my anxiety. I'm feeling anxious about that.
Yeah, I think that's true. Mm. There's the complication of anxiety as a feeling as opposed to anxiety as a condition.
Yeah.
And people often misuse those. But one other thing I wanted to mention about OCD, and that's something you'll hear if you listen back to other episodes where we've talked about OCD, is that the symptoms vary so widely. So actually this idea of someone being really neat and really getting easily anxious about anything being out of place is actually just one section of what that condition can be.
Yeah.
And for most people, that's not their only experience of OCD symptoms. And so we'll talk a little bit more in the episode about our guest today's specific experiences around OCD. I'm really glad to be covering particularly this combination of conditions, because with them both being conditions with symptoms that cross over, it can be difficult to understand what is one and what is the other and what is both of them, and how they can kind of trigger and bounce off each other.
So
I'm looking forward to sharing a bit more of that insight with our guest. One last statistic I have to mention is on anxiety conditions in general and how prevalent they are as a group of conditions, and this is from Anxiety UK, who found that more than 1 in 10 people are likely to have a disabling anxiety disorder at some stage in their life.
Wow, disabling being the key word there.
Yeah, so it will be, in fact, even higher, but this is where they've defined it by a certain level in that it interferes with somebody's day-to-day life.
Yeah.
And that is the complication of so many mental illnesses, that they can be really invisible. And as a result, many of them can be undiagnosed or untreated.
Absolutely. when it's your family members or your friends and you're noticing this person's not coming out or this person can't socialise or has to do things in certain ways, it has an impact, like you said, on the everyday life, socialising, work, school, college, relationships. Absolutely debilitating. And to think 1 in 10 people are suffering.
Yeah, and suffering to the extent where it can be described in that way.
Yeah.
Because that's the point, no matter how severe an illness is that can be described as a invisible illness, there can be this larger societal misconception that invisible is the same as it not existing.
Yeah.
And that's where the concern is, that there's many different types of illness that people are going through, and some of them you can see and some of them can't. In the same way, in our last episode when we were talking about disability, disability comes in all kinds of forms, and so many of them you can't see.
So many of them. And it's heartbreaking, actually, because I think anxiety is one of those things that unless you've had experience of yourself or you really have, you know, the ability to show empathy, or I think it's a mental illness that I think is, it's awful for those who have got it, who are living around people who just don't get it. It's so frustrating. And that those on the outside just can't understand why you can't just do whatever it is that you're struggling to do, or live your life that you, how you were living before. Or, you know, from my experience and experiences from my, you know, friends and family and people that I know that are suffering on different scales, it's really, really difficult because, as you said, it's invisible.
Yeah, for sure. You've actually reminded me of another episode we did there, which was the first episode we ever did on anxiety with a guest called Samantha Hearn. And she talked at some length about that, the challenges of explaining to family members what it is you're going through. And even on a separate note, quite a few of our guests have come back to us with the feedback that recording the podcast and us facilitating them articulately explaining their condition mm-hmm. has been a really useful tool to them.
Oh,
quite
brilliant.
A few guests have said that to me, where they're like, oh, it's great, I now send it to people in my life to be like, this is me explaining it at my best.
Yeah,
I'm in a bad place right now, I can't explain it that well, but that should give you an idea.
Yeah.
And that's really cool, because that's the kind of way we're benefiting people that I never would have guessed.
Well, absolutely. And as much as reading and as much academic knowledge that you might have, or, you know, experience that you've got, even for me, working on the podcast and actually meeting people and talking to people with so many different diagnoses and that going through, have had so many different experiences, is so enlightening. Like, there's nothing like it. So for them, I'm glad that it's great, and it's great for me and for you, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And just for reference, listeners, if you do want to listen to our first episode on anxiety, it's episode number 15. And the previous dual diagnosis episode on anxiety and depression was episode 24. So to circle back around to today's interview, one other thing we talked about briefly in the episode is drug taking and how that can be a factor in mental health. And so I found some interesting research from Anxiety Care UK mentioning this link. So I'll just read a paragraph from that. A significant number of people who reach out to Anxiety Care for help, particularly in their late teens and 20s, present with anxiety and depression that they link to abuse of recreational drugs at some point in their recent past. So when you hear our guest today talk about his experience, you'll get an idea of how that's an example of something that described here is very common for a lot of people. It can really change how they're coping with their mental health.
Yeah, and I don't think it's talked about enough. And even the argument around cannabis and the legalisation of it, I feel like what would come with legalisation, and I know it's a huge debate, but would become more learning and understanding if more, you know, more young people were aware that actually there were a large number of people out there who potentially have a predisposition to drug taking, and that it could damage them more than maybe, you know, their next door neighbour or their best friend at school. And I think if those risks were out there more, more people would be aware that actually he might have taken ecstasy pill at festival, I can't. I don't want to do that. That's not for me. As opposed to drugs are just, we all do it together. There's the prevalence is huge of mental illnesses after recreational drug taking, and it's not talked about enough. There's not enough awareness about it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So now that we've mentioned a little bit about our guest experience, we'll actually tell you who he is. It's George Hodson, who's an incredible speaker and activist on all things mental health and the designer of a brilliant mental health clothing line, which I think is really awesome. And so in the episode, he'll share his experience of both the conditions we're focusing on today and how overcoming them has led to where he is now with all the brilliant work he does. And as of recently, he even got featured in a BBC documentary as part of their Amazing Humans series. So if you do enjoy this interview, 100% go look up his clothing brand, but also maybe take a look at his Amazing Humans documentary with the BBC. You can just Google his name and then BBC to find that. Also, one other bit of good news is that we were shortlisted in the top 10 of health podcasts by the People's Choice Podcast Awards.
Woo!
Last time. Hopefully this time we might even win the award. So if you're enjoying the podcast and you want to contribute something towards us reaching even more people, do go along to the fucking web address. Danielle is laughing at me forgetting what I was saying because I'm too hot.
It's like being in Jamaica sat here today.
It is. We listeners,
fully dressed.
to give the listeners some context, we have to have all the windows closed in the studio whilst the sunlight is blaring in on us, because otherwise the outside noise would interfere with the recording. So we have like a brief break between episodes or between intros where we get to have a breeze.
Put the fans on, open the windows.
And then we have to close everything up again, and it just gradually gets warmer from there.
Hotter and hotter.
So what I was going to say about the podcast awards, if you do want to contribute towards us, maybe even winning one, you can visit podcastawards.com. I'll put a link for that in the episode description. And all you need to do is nominate us under the health category and the People's Choice Podcast of the Year categories. That's where we are. So thank you so much in advance for doing that. Fingers crossed that we do really well this year. Anything else you wanted to say ahead of this episode?
No, all good. Just looking forward to it.
Yeah. George is someone that I think you'll instantly connect with listening to this. He's very well spoken. He comes across as just as sweet on air as he is in real life. So you're in for a treat with this interview. We'll get into that in a moment, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
I'm George, and I'm an anxiety and OCD sufferer. So my journey, it kind of starts when I was very little. I used to have anxiety when I was, you know, primary school. I used to have breathing exercises at home, counting to 10, because I was so hyperactive all the time. And I'm still very hyperactive now. So through primary school, I had that extra support at home. And then I went through secondary school, and it kind of dissipated a little bit because I was always really busy, had lots to do, was always focused, had a good friends group, and didn't really worry about what I felt like.
So what experience had you had of any symptoms growing up? Were you aware of that?
I suppose I was too young to realise what it was exactly. I thought I was just a very hyperactive person. I just loved running everywhere. I just did everything so quickly. I just wanted to get everything done. But I was restless all the time. In classrooms, I was very restless. I was always moving. I always wanted to move and like shuffle and, you know, draw and be into the next thing all the time. I always want to get onto the next thing. So I guess I didn't really realise there was something wrong until the school kind of made it a problem. They kind of, they thought there's something wrong with him. He's too much. We can't manage him. Can you do something about it? So obviously my parents got some extra support at home, and I had to count to 10, breathing, to kind of try and calm me down and put into place these mechanisms when I was younger to kind of help me in primary school, to focus me a bit more, because I was always all over the place. So that was my first experience of realising that there was some sort of energy about me that was like overactive. So yeah, I mean, that was my first experience of something there. Just didn't really know how bad it was, really.
And were you aware before the school intervened of that difference between you and your peers?
Because I got on with people quite easily. I was just thought I was an energetic person, and everyone else was really quiet. I thought, you know, I was quite exciting, and everyone was really quiet. I didn't know
so
what it was.
So they're the weirdos.
Yeah, yeah. No, I just thought, because I'm kind of me, I didn't really worry about what other people thought of me. I was just me. So Yeah, and I'm still like that now, you know. I didn't really care what people think of me. I just stay in my lane, essentially, and that was what it was like back then. But I mean, I was younger, and you're kind of more ignorant of everything, which is lovely. You're almost too young at that stage to realise. My parents obviously thought, this is difficult, the school finding is difficult, how can we sort this out? And then a teacher came who understood young people and mental health problems and energetic kids, and he kind of recognised it and helped a bit with it and sort of knew how to handle me, as it were, and that really helped. But the head teacher was absolutely useless. So it got better near the end, and then I obviously went to secondary school.
Mm-hmm. You saying it got better, you were able to better sort of stay calm and controlled in the classrooms?
Yeah, because he knew instinctively how to manage me in a classroom. He knew what exercises to give me, what activities to give me, so I'd always stay focused and doing something different all the time to keep my mind busy. And that kind of made it feel like I wasn't an outcast.
That's really great that you had that experience with a teacher that got it more.
Mm.
Certainly what I hear from a lot of parents and even some teachers is that so many use ignoring as a tactic to try and calm down the kids that they see as troublesome. Yeah. And quite often that can just be that they're struggling to stay concentrated, whereas actually those kids need the engaging the most.
Yeah.
Certainly for myself, growing up with dyslexia, there was plenty of lessons I wasn't very interested in, but I was more interested in the human interaction. So if people could engage me, then I'd concentrate. But if I was just given a textbook to read through, something that I could hardly do anyway, I wasn't going to concentrate on that.
Yeah, no, 100%. I'm exactly the same. I'm very creative, very practical person, very hands-on, not very academic, don't like writing. I can't even read my own writing, really. I love reading books, I love reading, I love learning, I love knowledge. I learn in a different way. I learn by doing and failing and doing it again.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm the same. And so then you finished your schooling. What happened then?
So we finished secondary school. And so we were all quite excited because we finished school. You know, the most exciting thing in our lives to happen was that we had independence. So we all go to a festival and we all get loads of alcohol and thought, you know, we'll experiment with some drugs. So we bought some MDMA, ecstasy, commonly known as. And that didn't really have a very fun effect on me at all. I didn't enjoy it because obviously, as I just explained, I'm very hyperactive anyway. MDMA is a drug that makes you hyperactive.
Yeah,
so going from, I was like 100 already, it took me to like 1,000, and it was unbearable. I heard voices, I was hearing too many people, it was too light, it was too intense, like tunnel vision. I thought, this is horrible, I'm not enjoying this at all, sweating, too hot. So I thought, I won't be doing that again. But then subsequently, 16, tried it again at a party a week later, thought maybe it was just a bad trip. And then I thought I was actually dying, so it was not for me. Some people can take drugs, some people can't. I was one of those people that couldn't. So the first time I took it was obviously at the festival. We snorted it, so it was like a powder form. We snorted it, and it's through a 5-pound note. How exciting. And immediately, as smooth as I did it, I thought, oh no, this doesn't feel right. And about half an hour later, I was right. I felt most peculiar. Started hearing voices. Obviously, my hyperactive personality was taken from 100 to 1,000. Everything was too bright, too many voices. Everyone was asked, completely paranoid, and I didn't know what was going on. The problem with that type of thing is that it lasts. When you've taken it, you can't then get off it for however long it is. 6 to 9 hours, it was about that. And I was terrified. That was what's making it was like a fueled panic. I was just fueling it because I thought, oh my God, I'm on this. I'm scared. I've got another 6 hours of this. So I just kind of had to go and listen to the music with my friends to distract myself from being on it, which is peculiar. And then, you know, I didn't really like it. But as I was 16, I thought maybe it was just a bad trip. I'll try again, a party a week later. So I did, and I still didn't enjoy it. And I actually thought I was dying, went and sat behind the shed, kept blacking out. So I realised drugs weren't really for me. You know, some people can take them, some people can't. I was one of the people that can't, and I don't need them. You know, people take them sometimes to be more sociable, to talk to people. But I'm already very sociable. I don't need it. So yeah, that was my experience of taking the drugs. And I didn't really think much of it until kind of 3 weeks after that, when I was in the horse's field doing the dung, and I started feeling really hot, sort of like I was back on this MDMA at my parents' house in the horse's field. I thought, that can't be right. I haven't done anything. Is it still in my system? I thought, you know, the phrase coming up means waves is basically when the drug's kind of into your system and you start feeling the effects. And I felt that, similar to what I was going through at the festival. And I realised something was wrong. I thought, oh my God, I actually feel like I'm back on this drug. So I started sweating, tunnel vision, heart racing, feeling hot, and the tunnel vision came back. And I thought, there's something wrong here. I don't feel right. I'm scared. So I was scared, and I left everything and actually ran inside the house to tell my parents this. I thought, guys, I feel like I'm on ecstasy. I've done ecstasy. I'm sorry. I feel like I'm about to die. There's something wrong here. Help me. And they sort of looked at me they didn't do anything really. They didn't lash out, they didn't shout, they just said, okay, George, just sit down, calm down, we'll go through this. I couldn't sit down, I was running around the kitchen, I wanted to cry, I wanted to curl up in a ball, I wanted to run away. I didn't know what was going on. And then we called Handstock and they said, it sounds like he's having a panic attack. It turns out panic attacks are very close to the symptoms of MDMA. It's kind of mimic the same thing. So your heart races, you feel hot, you kind of get tunnel vision, everything's all bright, so it's fight or flight. Your body's preparing for something to happen. Your adrenaline spikes. On the MDMA, it's obviously doing a similar thing. So every time I was having a panic attack, I thought I was back on the MDMA, and it became a very vicious cycle. And the first panic attack I experienced was terrifying. It lasted about 45 minutes. Then I started experiencing them every day for a week until I said to my parents, can we go to the doctor? Something's wrong. So, yeah.
Wow, so 45 minutes of that.
It was unbearable. I didn't know what to do. Eventually they said, have you got a brown paper bag anywhere that you can breathe into? And we found one. And I started breathing into it to stop me hyperventilating, because you breathe too quickly. I need to slow down my breathing. Breathing's the first thing that goes. You can't breathe. You start panicking more about that. So I needed to breathe slowly. So that kind of helped. Then I just laid on the sofa and relaxed for a little bit. But it was, yeah, it was quite scary.
Yeah. And to be clear, if someone doesn't understand what happens with the paper bag, that's to make you more aware of your breathing.
Yes, right? Yeah, so you have to focus on your breathing. You're only focusing on the breathing because you're focusing on the bag going in, the bag going out. And that really helps. So then, subsequently, kept carrying a panic bag everywhere with me because it became a crutch. It was sort of, if I didn't go anywhere without the panic bag, I thought I'd have a panic attack. So I had to take this brown paper bag with me everywhere.
It's really interesting that you felt that you were on ecstasy, that the symptoms were so similar.
Yeah.
Because usually when we talk about panic attacks on the podcast, people describe their first one feeling like how they imagine a heart attack would.
Classic,
that, like,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
their kind of frame of reference. Yeah. So you'd experience something even closer.
Yeah.
And so your mind straight away went to that.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose what the mind does is the mind focuses on the fear of the unknown. So when you're having a panic attack, if you've never had one, you think you're having a heart attack. No one actually knows what a heart attack feels like until you had one, right? So yeah. I didn't immediately think of that. My brain was relating to something I'd felt before, which is much more comfortable for the brain to do. It was like 3 weeks prior to it happening. So my brain, you know, I immediately felt the hot, which immediately related to the snorting of the drugs. And I thought, oh my God, I feel like I've just done it again. And then it's kind of, I thought, I don't want to be on this. Oh my God, I'm at my parents' house. It spiraled until I was into a full-blown panic attack before realizing it. And it felt remarkably close and still does. You know, I sometimes still feel the hot come and it reminds me of what, or a smell. I reacted to smells very weirdly. So yeah.
And how did your parents react in the aftermath to the first one?
They were sort of very calm, quite scared, but they were calm. And they thought, okay, well, that was interesting. You know, we'll keep an eye on it. And the drugs thing, they were fine with. They thought, you know, he's going to do them sometime. And they were the parents that let me go out to give an idea. They had the house parties at the house, because then they thought, if he's doing it at the house, he's not doing it in a field somewhere for me to learn on my own. Whereas if they restricted me from everything, not letting me do anything, it could have gone completely off the rails. So I would have been rebellious and done everything. But they were there when this sort of fallout happens.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good approach. I can imagine a lot of parents would end up panicking to a similar level as their child going through something that is so different to what they will have experienced before. Mm. My parents, despite coming from a medical background, they're more physical health. I think they'd be on to, like, the head of every hospital they could think of. Because, you know, it's still your child. You can have all the know-how, but then the fear of looking after them in that moment and not knowing what to do can still take you over.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, they couldn't take me to the hospital. It's useless. Doctors, useless, really. So they thought, okay, we can just call someone. I couldn't go anywhere. So they thought, we'll just have to call someone. And Handstock was the next best thing, which is 111, I think. So, and they kind of talked me through it, which was probably the best thing. So.
Absolutely. And so then you kept having them every day. Were they of the same kind of intensity and length?
Yeah, and it became a peculiar situation because I was just lying in bed and started having one. I thought, what the hell? Like, I'm just having a panic attack in bed. I haven't done anything yet. And then I realised that I've got to see a doctor. There's something wrong here. I'm just having a panic attack for no reason. So we do. We go down to the doctor and the GP, and he's very sympathetic with adolescent mental health. And he said, it sounds like you've got anxiety and panic disorder. And obviously the anxiety clicked with my parents when I was at primary school, not to the severity. But then he said, we're going to refer you to CAMHS, which obviously is very ubiquitous at the moment. And the assessment for that appointment was 2 weeks after the GP appointment. But in the 2 weeks I was waiting for it. My mental health severely deteriorated. So obviously the panic attacks worsened, the anxiety worsened, and I developed OCD from this, because what was happening was I was relating everything to drugs. My brain completely focused on these drugs, and almost like a psychosis, drug paranoia. I thought there were drug traces on everything. So this table and this microphone, and I thought there'd be drug traces on it. So I'd have to go and wash my hands, otherwise I'd have a panic attack, because I thought the drugs could seep through my system into my blood, result me in having a panic attack. So then I had to keep washing my hands, and it spiraled out of control, and I was washing 50 to 100 times a day just because I thought there were drug traces on it. Mum was going through so many soaps, and just started buying this really cheap soap because it was too expensive to keep buying, you know, Bayliss and Harding or something ridiculous, when I was just going through it all the time. And that was in a 2-week period. So then I started experiencing the suicidal thoughts because it was just too exhausting. I thought, this is just way too exhausting. I can't do this anymore. The anxiety and the OCD and the panic attacks, I thought, this is just, my life is shrinking. I eventually became sort of reclusive into my bedroom. I went everywhere with my parents. If I went out, if they were going to a party, I had to go with them because I didn't want to be on my own anywhere. Yeah, my world sort of shrunk, really. So that was before the accountant's appointment. And then the accountant's appointment came along and was a shocker. So, yeah.
It's interesting hearing it, though, because as maladaptive as those compulsions through your OCD were, it does kind of make sense on the face of it that you hadn't had the support properly yet through the NHS. And so instead, your mind was just going to, okay, well, what's the most logical thing that will have caused this? Yeah. You'd already made this connection that being on drugs and having a panic attack felt similar. And so that was very much what you got fixated on. I can really see the kind of the train of logic in lieu of being given more medical answers.
It comes down to ignorance or not being educated on what was going on. I had no idea what I was going through, purely because I didn't know what it was. No one told me at school, well, you might experience anxiety and this is what it would feel like and this is what a panic attack is. Now, I knew how to put a condom on a banana, but I didn't know anything about my own mental health. So when it came to the doctor, I was terrified. He said, you've got anxiety and panic disorder. And I was like, what is that? What the hell is that? What does that entail? What's going to happen to me? Is that like terminal? Like, I didn't know what it was. And, you know, everything, it comes down to ignorance. Ignorance is sometimes not bliss.
And were they able to give you any answers in the GP surgery?
Kind of. He explained it briefly. I don't really remember it much there. But I just remember him telling me I'm going to CAMHS. And I still didn't really get many answers there. And that's the bit that kind of shocks people. He put me on some medication. He prescribed me propranolol, which is a beta blocker, which sort of stops the adrenaline running through your system. So the panic attacks kind of stop, basically. Stop dead, because like there's no adrenaline in your body at all, so you don't feel anything. And then it was the CAMHS appointment came along.
And so was that your experience then, that you went on the beta blockers and the panic attacks stopped completely?
In a way.
Lessened?
Yeah, lessened in a way. There was sometimes so intense that they kind of broke through. I felt the sensations that were there. I felt peculiar because it was trying to happen, but it wasn't happening, so I didn't really know what was going on. And then, we went to CAMHS and we had an assessment. I don't even know what an assessment is. I don't know what's being assessed for. And, you know, the lady said, we'll be able to help you. We'll get you through it. Everything's going to be okay. And then she said at the end, there's about a 40-week waiting list to get this help, though. And my parents just kind of fell silent. I was obviously crying through the whole thing, telling my story. And I was like, I didn't really know. I was lost for words. I had no idea what to say. I thought, I'm this bad now in 40 weeks. What am I going to do? So we actually left feeling far worse.
And things had already escalated so quickly for you. That's the last thing you want to hear.
Yeah, so my parents were scared. I was very scared. So we went back to the GP, same guy. And he said, you know, my parents said, is there anything you can do for him? He's just been told he's got to wait 40 weeks and we're quite scared. And the GP just said, can you afford to go privately? That's basically all he said. He said, I can recommend someone if you can. I'm very fortunate my parents could afford to send me privately. So, you know, within the week, we were seeing a private psychiatrist.
I mean, that's crazy to me. I mean, luckily, that experience, as extreme as it is in the minority.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly of what I hear and what the stats say. But still to hear that a GP recommended going private.
Mm.
I mean, my aunt's the GP.
Yeah.
She's not recommended private to anyone. She's like, no, come to my surgery.
Yeah. But what can she do if someone's so desperate?
But that's it, if the resources just aren't there. And maybe that was something to do with your local area or funding.
Another thing it comes down to is parents knowing what to do. What do you do when you've been told you've got to wait 40 weeks for the apparent only support you can get from CAMHS? I was 16, so I was eligible for it. But what do you do when you've just been told you've got to wait 40 weeks? Where do you go? So my parents did the natural thing, went to the GP. if you have the resources, you can do it. If you don't, what do you do? And that's what I'm campaigning for, what I'm doing now, because what the hell do you do? It's quite terrifying, obviously, in different areas, but...
Yeah, but they certainly did the right thing going back to the GP and finding out about other options.
Yeah.
Even as you say, though the option given wasn't one that most people could access. But I think a lot of that is part of bigger problems with how the system is at the moment, that so much of mental health support is just reactive. Your parents seem to respond really well and be really supportive and not worry in a way that worried you more.
Mm.
But for a lot of parents, that would be the natural thing to do if they don't know how to help you.
It's scary. So they kind of did what they could with the resources they had. Mm-hmm. So,
do you remember what type of counselling you started?
Yeah, very vividly. I started with, obviously, the adolescent psychiatrist, and he was doing hypnotherapy with me. He was specialising in... He also prescribed me pregabalin, which I think is an antipsychotic SSRI, which was balancing the chemicals in my brain while I was learning to manage what I was going through. So he was focusing on the panic attacks, because we had to stop those before anything else, because I couldn't do anything. So he was using hypnotherapy to do that between under the subconscious mind, getting you really relaxed and talking to you and talking you through the sensations of the panic attack to get you used to them. So I was sort of feeling them while I was relaxed and in a really calm state. So when I had one in real life, I thought, oh, you know, I felt this before, this is just a panic attack, I can manage this, just breathe. So he was kind of managing that. And he did that for about a year and a half before he then referred me to a CBT therapist, which was, again, private. So, and obviously cognitive behavioural therapy, I was learning coping mechanisms to be able to deal with the anxiety. This was the anxiety and the OCD I was being taught now to deal with. And that was kind of a bit of everything, really. A bit of rational thinking, a bit of stop thinking, you know, stop the thoughts before it even happens. And the rational thinking was, I'm a hypochondriac anyway, so when I'm anxious, it's even worse. So every time I had a headache, I thought I had something like a brain tumour. And there was like no in between. It was like headache, brain tumour, I'm going to die. So we had to stop that. So I was imagining, I've got a headache, it's quite hot outside, I haven't had much water, maybe I'm just dehydrated. And I was breaking the thoughts down inside my head so I could process them easier. And once you do that, you start breaking everything down. You know, if you go to a party, oh my God, what if I fall over and break my neck or spill wine on someone? What is the reality of that happening? It could happen. What's the worst that's going to happen? Someone will tidy it up. So you break down the thoughts and it becomes a much less scary monster. So he was teaching me that, and that was for another year and a half. Near the end of that, I was obviously being weaned off the medication because I didn't want to become dependent on it. It was on this beautiful estate, and we just started walking around the gardens and just talking about how I was feeling that day. And I realised that actually just by talking how I was feeling made me feel better. And I left feeling quite good. You know, I got it off my chest. I'm told someone I'm feeling like this. And I realised that was the light bulb moment. I thought, talking helps. This is helping me. If I talk to my family or tell my friends that I've got anxiety or tell anyone that I've got anxiety, immediately alleviates the anxiety. Because, you know, when people, if you're at an event or talking to someone, they think he's being weird. If you say, actually, I've got social anxiety, they'll be like, oh, right, that's why you're being weird. There's like immediately the air is clear because there's nothing that can worry you that people think you're being like sort of strange. So I just told everyone. I was like, yeah, no, actually, I've got anxiety. I'm quite quiet for that reason. And it really helped. So
yeah. And I think in that you've highlighted a really great point about anxiety, about how key it is to get these things out in the open and specifically out of your own mind.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it's something you're fighting on your own, and it makes it so much more difficult to look at your fears, your anxieties objectively, because they feel so real in here, whereas actually a lot of people experience that as soon as they've explained why they're feeling particularly bad that day, it doesn't seem so bad. The words don't feel as bad as the feelings are inside.
Yeah.
And I think that's also one of the things that a lot of people don't understand about panic attacks, that they're like the extreme of that. Those feelings and those symptoms are so all-encompassing that it's almost impossible to have any third-person perspective without learning that.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you were really being taught those techniques.
Yeah, exactly that. To sort of come out, sort of out your shell and look at yourself from another view. I think, what's the reality of that actually happening? And like pushing the monster down, kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise you do feel like you're literally dying.
Yeah, it's true. And the classic, the faster you run, the quicker the thoughts are going to chase you. You just run from them. They're just going to keep coming. You just got to face them and head on and go straight through them. And then they'll just disappear.
Mm-hmm. And so when you had that, what you describe as a light bulb moment, did that really just change your whole approach then?
Yeah, I started focusing my energy around that, my recovery around that, and just talking more, doing more talking. And then it became apparent that I started to get better when I woke up in the morning thinking, oh God, I've got to go to therapy today. It became sure. I didn't think, oh, I don't need it anymore. I can go out without needing this. And that's when I realised actually I was getting better. And then he said, oh, you know, tell me when you're ready to leave me. And it's like a relationship. It's this sort of you, it's not me. Or it's me, it's not you. And I did. I said, I think I'm ready to stop seeing you now. And from there, I stopped seeing him. It was a bit of a scary moment. You know, I thought, oh my God, what have I just done? Like, my only support is gone. But I realised, actually, I can do it on my own. I've been doing it on my own for 3 weeks or a month that I've not seen him. And it was sort of the best thing I did. It was just talking about it.
Right, absolutely. But also, when you're getting that support privately, there is that privilege of being able to go back.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something I remind myself because I have private counselling, and that, you know, really helps me a lot. And I feel like there's, I've got plenty of content to keep going for a few more years, to be honest. Mm. But, you know, there is that nice safety blanket of knowing that if I did go, then I could always go back and probably to the same person.
Yeah.
But no, it is important to realise that as much as you're getting the support, the progress is still within you. Mm. And so that's not going to instantly stop when you get out of this routine of going to therapy. And it's great to hear that you kind of got that seemingly instinctively.
Yeah, that's essentially how I learn. And it kind of kicked in. They were just sort of helping find my way of doing it.
And how long ago was that?
Gosh, 4 years ago now.
And so how have things been since then?
Good, yeah, not too bad. I never see you really cured from mental illness because it's always going to be there. All help does is kind of teach you the coping mechanisms to be able to deal with it in your own way. So when it does get bad, you have those, you're equipped with them to say, I can do this. I've got the mechanisms to be able to manage this, and this is what I'm going to do that. And just accepting it sometimes. You know, if you're having a bad day, just take a day off. It's okay to take one day off. The world is not going to end just because you've taken a day off. And realising that is a big thing. You know, a lot of people beat themselves up about it. But it's okay to do it. Because I know, you know, deep down, with the mechanisms I've been taught, that the next day will feel better for it. And whatever makes you feel better, you should really embrace. So yeah, things are good now, and I'm busy, and I'm obviously doing my campaigning, and I'm doing my public speaking around my story, and helping other young people. So in a way, my career has been shaped from my story, and I've realised that I want to change the way mental health is sort of seen, and make it more proactive as opposed to reactive. You know, education in schools is where it needs to start. Really, really needs to start there. So yeah, you know, my life is based around mental health as a career.
Yeah.
Really fascinating.
But no, that's great that you've managed to find skills in what you've been through.
Mm.
I would never regret any mental illness I've been through because I've come out stronger for it.
Yeah.
You described something a bit similar there in that these experiences really open your eyes to the natural ups and downs of mental health anyway.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of people can be quite ignorant to it, and a lot of that is around lack of education, but then once you've got through it and you've built up coping mechanisms, then you can see a little bit of anxiety and kind of preemptively tackle that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the most important thing. It's kind of learning that, and you're always learning, and it's important.
And one other thing I wanted to ask you about, in terms of your OCD and the kind of tendencies you were experiencing through that, did they naturally reduce as you got the support as well?
They did, yeah. I got homework from both the counsellors and therapists and psychiatrists, and that was difficult because I thought, oh God, homework. But I so badly wanted to get better. I was doing it. I thought, I'm so sick of this. I'm so sick of this being ill. And so I did it, and then they started to sort of dissipate. Yeah, the OCD kind of started going away, and I got better, and just sort of, it comes back to the focusing on the thoughts more. You know, what's actually going to happen if I don't wash my hands? Or what's actually going to happen if I do wash my hands? Nothing. Because I was checking the doors locked a lot of the time as well. Just a weird one. And I thought, the door is definitely locked. So I've checked it. I remember checking it. And I do like check marks or markers in my head of when I've done an event. So I actually remember doing it. Because the OCD will like bypass all of that and think, is the door locked? When did you last check? And, oh God, I didn't check. Oh my God. And then you think, actually, I did check because I saw that on the way down to check. So that really helps. And then, yeah, just getting better and giving into the OCD is not going to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like you were really proactive in it and really embraced the support and the process of getting better. Do you find those compulsions still come up in the back of your mind even now?
They come up, but I kind of put them back down. You know, you've got to hit them with a bat and just just put them back down and say, no, that's not going to happen. They do come back more in when I'm tired. I'm tired and vulnerable. They're better because I'm weak. You know, I'm quite tired, can't do it. When you're tired, it's really difficult to manage your thoughts. You just kind of let them flow, and that's why you feel like crap. So when I'm tired, they kind of get through, but I still don't act on them. There's a difference between thinking it and acting on it. You know, an action is different from a thought. If you think it, you can think it. I can think them all I want, as long as I don't act on it. Because once you've acted on it, you'll act on it again and again and again. So yeah, you can think it, but don't act on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a clear distinction between having obtrusive thoughts and having OCD. It's about the behaviours and the feeling, the need to do something compulsive, regular, and physical.
Yeah.
You've really transformed not only your life, but now you're supporting so many other people.
So
do you want to... you are, definitely. So do you want to share a little bit more about the work you do now?
Yeah, so the first and foremost thing I kind of do is my brand, Maisons Tube, and that was started from that dark place. So when I was ill, obviously I wasn't at college because I had to leave. I finished the first year and then didn't go back, and I didn't have a job. So I had all this time on my hands, and I used to write down all my thoughts and my feelings, and used to draw them sometimes, and sometimes quite dark, didn't really make any sense. But this was my way of expressing myself, and I didn't have the talking mechanisms to be able to do it. So I did loads of these drawings, and as I started to get better, I went down to Dad's office with them and was playing around with them on Photoshop, adding colour, manipulating them, sort of playing around with them, looking at Pinterest for ideas, and I thought, maybe I could put this on something just to express what I'm going through. And I landed on the idea of a t-shirt, and I thought, that's a good idea. I could wear what I'm going through. Well, great idea. Bought myself a screen printing kit, tried doing it, went horribly wrong. But I thought, actually, this idea of expressing myself through fashion is quite a good one. And if I'm talking to someone and they say, oh, what's that about? I can then say, oh, actually, this is about me and I'm suffering from anxiety. So it's kind of preempting the conversation. That's when I had the idea that actually using fashion as a vehicle to raise funds and awareness for mental health in general was a good one, because I thought everyone wears fashion. If I can do it in a way that doesn't scream I've got anxiety, then I'll give it a go. And I asked Dad, I said, Dad, you know, would you laugh at me if I wanted to start my own business? And he said, no, go for it, good luck. Because both my parents were self-employed and they both wear them themselves, so he was kind of supportive of me on that. And I did, and I looked around for some people to print my designs, and it took about a year to find someone to help with it, because yeah, I had no fashion knowledge, no business knowledge. So I thought, I'll give it a go. And I got someone to help me with self-to-self, kind of direct it in the way of fashion and how do we get into the fashion world with this idea. Because I needed someone to be able to put them on a t-shirt in a way that looked like an actual design. Because what I had was like scribbles in a book, and it just didn't make any sense. So it was taking that and making it applicable to a fashion product. Then the brand launched, and it's going very well. It's growing in a slowly but surely positive way, and lots of people are getting on board. All the designs are about mental health in a subtle, non-triggering way, and anyone can wear them. You know, they're good quality t-shirts, but they don't scream, I've got a label. You know, I've got anxiety, I've got depression. That's the whole point of the brand, is that they're there. They look like cool designs, but if someone says, that's quite nice, where's that from? Which still starts the conversation, and then obviously the 25% from certain collections goes to Young Minds charity to help the young people who aren't in the fortunate position to go privately like I was, because I thought, what the hell do people do if they've just been told they've got to wait 40 weeks? That's scary. So I thought, I'm going to use this to give back. If I can use it as a platform to give back, I'll do that. So I did. And I myself, by just sort of sharing my story, realised that actually I could branch out and do my own thing. So I was like, oh great, this is my first speaking opportunity, it's going to be amazing. I practiced my speech with my uncle, and then I looked at the list of people that have spoken at Condé Nast College of Fashion and Design previously, and I thought, oh my god, it's like Tommy Hilfiger, Victoria Beckham, and they've got this like 20-year-old boy coming in to speak about his story about mental health. I'm not going to live up to this expectation, what do they want me for? But actually, I just stood up there in front of them and told my story. I was quite nervous because it was my first one, and they could probably see that, but it was just me telling my story and saying, look, I'm a boy, I'm 20 years old, I've got feelings, this is my story, this is the brand I started from it. And the amount of support I got, and people messaging me on Instagram afterwards saying, your story's really helped me, because essentially what I was doing, I was coming up and saying, it's okay to suffer from mental health problems, it's okay to experience, you know, hardship and go through it. And everyone was sort of wanting someone to say it, but didn't know who to talk to about it and didn't know how to say it. So from there, I've started doing more, and I realised that actually I love telling my story and I love helping people. So I go to schools, yeah, colleges, unis.
And it also sounds like you stumbled on something really important there, that they felt validated by you sharing an experience they could relate to.
Yeah.
And actually, so often in our society, I think there is this pressure to be perfect first.
Yeah.
That you can sort of talk about your hard times, but only in an autobiography when you're famous.
Yeah.
That it's like, it's okay if it's in the past, but actually you being nervous on the day is somehow frowned upon.
Yeah.
And yet the reality is that's authentic and people connect with that.
Yeah, and it kind of boggles the mind a bit, really, when you think about, I stand on stage in front of 250, 350 young people on a Monday morning when they're 16, a week before half term. Like, are they going to listen to me? And I just stood in front of them and told my story, and they were kind of like, this is peculiar. There's someone standing in front of me talking about snorting drugs and suffering from panic attacks and anxiety. What is this about? And then at the end, they kind of realised that if he's talking about it in front of all of us, why can't I talk about it? And it starts that conversation in the sort of the school. And then they'll be going away and saying, that was a good, you know, good speech. I actually relate to some of those symptoms. And but without realising, you've started this conversation in the school where everyone's talking about their mental health. And it's completely broken the stigma. But yeah, it's very positive. So I go into companies now and do speaking because companies are a big focus of mine. You know, schools are fantastic, and I'm working on that with Young Minds as an area that they need to sort of get the education officer needs to stop focusing on academic grades so much and focus on well-being, wellness. And then I'm focusing on companies because companies need to learn about this way, probably more so because company culture is huge. You know, if you can't, it's fantastic that all these people are getting first aid mental health trained in companies, but that's a reactive thing again. Like, if someone's having a panic attack, great, you can put someone to that person, but how do you change the culture inside a company to get it, to get everyone feeling comfortable that they can go to their manager and say, I'm suffering, can I have a week off? Because people can't do it.
If they still fear speaking up and asking to see the mental health first aider, then it's not really progress.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool. So really exciting. And in terms of the clothing business, the designs are so good.
Thank you.
So you've done a brilliant job.
Thank you.
Getting it from the scribbles.
Yes, indeed. That's
the wonderful succinct messages you put through now.
Because I see someone, I just see, why is anyone going to wear that? I saw one recently that was like OCD and it said obsessive cat disorder. And I was like, no, just what is that? So one of the things we go really big on is getting the message out there in a way that people still want to wear the t-shirts and feel cool and look cool and feel comfortable in without feeling like they're wearing a label.
And if people want to go have a look, maybe even buy one?
Everyone should go and buy one. It's just maisonthetube.co.uk, and that is maisonthetoup. And the name, before anyone asks, it comes from...
I was going to ask you to share that. It's very cute, this
one. Yes, so the name actually comes from Maison D is household in French, and Toup was my sister Charlotte when I was younger. I think I put Charlotte Poops together, Toup. And yeah, so I sort of named it after her. It's House of Charlotte because she's always there for me and very close. So yeah, little dedication to her, essentially.
So that's really lovely. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Is there any last kind of parting message you'd want to give the listeners before we finish?
Oh gosh, I'm very bad at these like inspirational bits, but essentially just everything's going to be okay, and sort of when you feel ready to get better, it happens. So
The support is out there. It's not always the easiest to get to, as your story is testament to, but it is there. And every day there's more people speaking up like yourself. The mental health charities continue to grow. And so we are, we're getting there.
Yeah.
Thanks again for being on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.